Interview with Sidney Gelber, Friday, October 30th, 87. That's what I'm interested in getting also from you. Who else should I interview? I was thinking of Hugh Cleland. I haven't interviewed Tom or Francis yet.
Right.
Or Swartz, individually.
Yes, individual. I know we talked with you at first as a group.
Yeah.
have you thought of getting hold of John F. Lee?
I would like to. I don't know where he is, and I think probably Tom Irvine does.
Tom Irvine would know.
Right.
He would know. He's been in touch with him on occasion.
Yeah.
So he probably would know. But he would be interesting, an important figure.
And Olson himself and Austell.
Mm-hmm.
I probably should see them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that Austell is easy to get hold of. He's in New York City.
Right.
I'm just thinking now. Did you get Feingold?
Arnie, I haven't yet.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, he was the first graduate dean.
Is he here?
Yeah, he's retiring the end of this year, I think. There's
right.
As a matter of fact, December something, I forget the date. I was told they're going to have a little thing in the physics department.
Right. Right.
So he'll be retiring, I guess, the end of this academic year.
Yeah.
Who else?
I don't want to confine it to the Oyster Bay days.
No, no, and I think it would be a mistake if you did, because I frankly think the whatever happened there happened. In some sense, it was important what happened later. On the other hand, it was just kind of the beginnings of certain things that were to occur, to emerge later.
Prolegomenos.
That's right, exactly. So, over-stressing that or over-focus on that, it would be would have limited value. The I'm thinking in terms of later developments in the...
I'd like to get the 3 years where I was running it.
Right.
And then John Toles.
Right. Well, you had, let's see, at the time, of course, Harry Potter played an important role.
Yeah. But his memory, I have interviewed him
mm-hmm.
down in Chapel Hill. His memory isn't too good.
Mm-hmm.
He has a little trouble with his speech, but outside of that, he's fine.
Right. Who else is critical then? Well, there was always Bruce Thiering, came in there, who was president of Binghamton and then became academic vice chancellor.
I see.
For a period almost, well, came a little after Toll came in and was there for a number of years.
Mm.
He had been president when Toll came in. He was president of Binghamton. Then they moved him into central administration when Boyer, I guess after Gould. No, it was. I'm not sure when Gould, if he came when Gould was still there.
But you're right. I should try to find him. I don't know where he is.
I have no idea where he is. I guess people in central administration would know.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of key people we were all dealing with in Albany.
Right. Well, the people in Albany.
You've got a good number of them, actually.
Stevens,
yeah,
Charlie Foster,
Steve, right.
George Dudley at Construction Fund, Norm Hurd was director of the budget,
correct,
and Larry Murray,
Porter. What's his name, director, the fellow who we dealt with in the budget for a number of years. He was a central figure for all higher education.
Axelrod was one of them.
Well, Axelrod was one. Axelrod and then...
Villette?
Yes, Villette.
Villette?
Right. Oh, Paul right. Villette.
Paul Villette.
Paul Villette. He was there at a very critical time, I guess.
What is your impression of the people in the budget? I only sat in, I think, on one or possibly two of those sessions. I didn't get much of an impression of them.
Well, I think they, my own sense of it over time, I think in the earlier days, their role and function, so far as the university is concerned, was difficult to decipher, because to a very large extent, Rockefeller ran the show.
Right.
Rockefeller determined what was going to be done. And the division of the budget, I think, simply was a rubber stamping operation. But after Rockefeller left, it became a much more serious problem. And since the university didn't have that kind of natural protector
yes.
behind it,
right.
The division of the budget became more crucial and serious right. a role and factor in this. And Villette was there right through the Carey years.
Governor Carey, yes.
And he was eventually, I think, to play a pretty important role because he had to make certain policies as to the kinds of arguments we were making at Stony Brook, that the four university centers, even though they were all university centers, they were not all alike, and that therefore this institution had to be treated somewhat differently. We tried to work out rational arguments and justifications for a method of budgetary differentiation of support. Mm-hmm. And it was Villette who had to be the one finally sold on this, and I think he was, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
He was an important figure for the support that Stony Brook got, I think. And then, of course, the very crucial thing, the hospital coming.
The hospital, yeah.
And that, Villette, I think, was very central there, too.
Mm-hmm.
He had a chap, Fernandez, what was his name? Fernandez? Who worked for him, but Villette would know who the key people were. I guess he may have gone to some other agency. I don't know where Paul Villette is now.
I think I have his telephone number. Right. I was going to interview him the last time I was up to see Drew, who was up there in Albany. And Villette was going somewhere else, so we missed each other. But I will get him the next time I go
he's
back.
He's an important
out.
Person because he, especially in those Carey years, the division but became a more important agency. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they weren't just the rubber stamp; they were really making policy,
yes.
and they had to make. It was my view too that during this critical period when Carey came in, that central administration for SUNY in Albany was much less effective and much less capable of making important decisions. I guess they didn't want to get involved in a lot of the politics that the consequences of that would have. So.
This
a lot of it fell into the division of the budget.
Was this under Sam Gould or was it under Ernie Boyer?
It came under Ernie Boyer, I think. And then another interesting thing came, I think, which always I was puzzled about. Boyer changed the structure of central administration, unlike what had been in place under Gould. And I think that was a major era, and it created major problems, I think, for the university centers, in Stony Brook in particular, because he tried to design central administration like the campus administration organization, with a chancellor, a vice chancellor for academic affairs, one for student affairs, and so on, which
yeah.
would be a typical campus organization.
Yeah.
And the big change was made that we had, in the Gould years, we had someone who represented, who was a vice chancellor for university centers, reporting
yes.
directly to the chancellor.
Who was he?
What's his name? He was at Brooklyn College later. I don't know if he's still around. I'll remember. He was the, if we have any bullets from those years, He went to Brooklyn College later, and what was his name? I believe he came from Columbia.
Well, I don't know.
His background was in history.
Wasn't Commissar.
No, Commissar's more recent. No. No, he was a very impressive person and was the he was the vice chancellor for university centers under Sam Gould.
I see.
And it was Boyer who made that change and who altered the whole structure so that what you got was a vice chancellor for academic affairs who represent all the institutions for your college, university, and so on. So, and I thought that was a major problem and gave less emphasis to the university center structures. As a result, we formed a special group, the four university centers, academic vice presidents, and graduate dean, formed a special kind of council to coordinate policies, everything from graduate student support to the special things that we needed, such as libraries and whatnot, in the development of formulas for support for the university centers.
Yeah.
And we became rather active and met regularly. And then it was at that point that they appointed a special individual that was he came in from Buffalo from the School of Pharmacy, Dan Murray, came in as a head of graduate programs. He went back to Buffalo. He was dean of School of Pharmacology, came in to...
Why did they appoint him?
Because they began to, I think, be aware that with the complaints we're making that there should be someone to oversee essentially the work of the university centers, particularly graduate programs and research. And so Demmer became the first representative for Ernie Boyer, actually working under Bruce Thiering. But his focus was meeting and working with and developing policy on graduate education and on research. And that was a very important term because when the State Education Department decided to review throughout the state of New York all PhD programs, Dan Murray was in place already. And he coordinated the whole review of doctoral programs for SUNY for the chancellor out of central administration.
How did we make out on that?
We did pretty well. As a matter of fact, there was some interesting background years there too. Stony Brook, we had made up our minds because we had heard rumblings in the background that perhaps Albany might wish to challenge the authority of State Ed Department to undertake not only reviews, but if need be, to close down programs where they would feel to be necessary. We felt that we were prepared to be evaluated in all programs. And Albany did it, seriously challenging the courts and would turn down. It was an embarrassment, I think, to SUNY, to the Board of Trustees, and certainly to Albany, because they challenged some rulings. I think one had to do with English, one, I think, to history and so on.
Right.
And Dan Murray was very much opposed to this challenge. But I think here he ran into a conflict with Ernie Boyer, who was, in effect, had been sold a bill of goods by the Albany people. And some of the trustees thought, although some of the trustees thought it was not a winnable fight, but they went into it anyway, and they lost.
Who were some of our supporters among the trustees? Do you remember Warren at all?
Yeah. Real supporters? I was always very, very puzzled about what real supporters we had in the trustees. I never felt wholly comfortable. Hard to say, because as they added people from the downstate area, because the early years were dominated really with upstate people.
Sure,
and,
right.
I could never regard their interest necessarily as coinciding with ours. I do know that when we still were trying to get in 1976, it may have been the approval for our doctoral program of music, that I was in touch with the state ed people who were very supportive of it. We had excellent reviews from various sources. And it was running into problems. We thought it would be in the trustees. Eventually ended up with some problem in the regents, but it was very limited. Nothing happened. They approved the program.
Right.
But there was some rumblings around, but I don't think we ever got that kind of strong political support from the trustees as Buffalo was to get, mm-hmm. As certain colleges would get because they had champions for their purposes. Jean Thayer, I think, a very fine person. She's very interested in the arts, but I think her main influence was really for purchase development. I think when what's her name came on the board from representing the island, her husband is
Moyers,
Judith Moyers came on. I think she saw her interest really more with Old Westbury.
The parochial view for these people.
I know, and I think that's one of the problems. I don't think we ever had sort of spokesman in that sense.
Yeah. The overall state view that you find in the Heald report, for instance, was not duplicated after Rockefeller left.
No. I think that's the big critical difference.
Yes.
I think Rockefeller, both in spirit and in substance and action, pursued the intent of the Heald Commission, and more so. But I think after he stepped down, there was a change apparent right away in the leadership, both at the governor's level, at the trustee level, I think, clearly. So long as Rockefeller's there and Gould was there, I think there was not so much of a problem at all. It
right.
was clear that the Heald Commission's basic objectives would be fulfilled. But then that kind
Excuse
of...
Excuse me, are you in touch at all with Sidney Ticton? I've been trying to find him.
No, Ticton was a crucial figure because he helped devise the master plan.
I know it. Do you know where he is? I've tried to locate him. You know?
One point... Well, yeah, I met him on a couple occasions. He was...
If you could find his address or telephone number...
I could try and track that. One person who might know, possibly, because he was involved with some group of institutions out west for a while, and coordinating their development of master plans and policies. A person who may have had interaction with him. One I know at one point was Bill Moran, who you have on your list. But now he might know because he was very actively involved, and so was Alec Pond on mm-hmm. certain of the things. Now Alec may know more about because he's now in his position at Rutgers.
Right.
He's second in command there. You haven't Alec on your list yet.
No.
Yeah.
Some time ago, he said he would see me. But
he of course is very crucial.
I know he's crucial. He's quite bitter, and
that I know too.
Yeah,
yeah. But I mean, certain of the information because he developed a plan early on in those early years when Tull first came. He chaired the committee. I was asked to serve on it. To draw the first master plan for Stony Brook. Before Tull took over, in that we came, I guess, July or whatever it was, when he started his presidency, or the September.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
A committee was set up to work that summer. Alec chaired it, and there was myself on it. There was Bob LeCashman, who was just coming to university, '65. Bentley was not to come till September, so we did the work before Bentley arrived.
Right.
Ticton, I think we had eventually a meeting with Ticton on that plan, because this is what Gould wanted, and we were the first campus to have it already in time. As I recollect, we had a meet, Tipton came down. So I think what happened was Gould got hold of him early on. Whether he was working for, Tipton was working for the legislature still, or he was working for SUNY Central, I can't remember. Alec would know, because I think he had, as the chairman of the committee, he may have had correspondence there. But we had, early on, we presented our plan, and that became sort of the first master plan that we had, that Gould wanted at the time. I'm saying Alec spoke because he had his hands on all these materials and documents and whatnot. I know he's bitter. I know that fully well. I wish he would, you know, talk about some of these things, because he probably...
Would you like to go with me to interview him?
I'd be glad to if that would help.
Sure. I think it might.
Sure. I think so.
Your relations with him were good.
Yeah, I mean, there were times when we had differences on certain matters of how to handle things, there's no question. But essentially, just as I had different with Johnny on some of these very things, and Alec was essentially Johnny's creation as his alter ego, and that's the way he used the term, you know.
Yeah.
So that a lot of what was going on in the preparation of the basic arguments, the basic structure, and so on, that Toll used was really all created by Alec. Alec was the person who developed the first funding formulas that was later to be adopted by the by Vallette and others. So he went to these major groups around the country that were beginning to develop systematized methods for evaluating budgetary planning and structure of camps, and that's where he ran to Tipton and others. So Alec was a key activity. I'd be glad to go if that would help.
I think it would.
Yeah,
because I think you could ask better questions.
Well, I was around a lot of that time, even though I didn't get into the senior magistrate until somewhat later. But that first year, even I was working there. Well, for one thing, I was in the search committee for the presidency, and then worked...
At the time that Gould came?
No, at the time Johnny came.
At the time,
yeah.
Johnny came.
And then I was on that special committee that drafted the master plan, and then later, when I came back from my leave, Johnny asked me to...
When was your leave?
64, 65. It was a 2 year. I was with Manus College, you remember. We thought we would get that merger with them. And Gould, that was a very interesting chapter, too. We had Gould ready to incorporate Stony Brook for a whole center for the arts. And John Newfield and I drafted that great plan. And with your great support behind us, we went to all the Gould was very happy. And then finally, the whole thing was to go up in smoke. The plan and all was taken over to the formation of for the formation of the purchase, because Hirschhorn had just made it known that he had this big art collection he was ready to give away, and Rockefeller wanted it. And I remember Gould getting me on the phone and saying, gee, I'm sorry, because we had planned all these things. He had already sold the idea to the Board of Trustees, the possible merger and development arts center. He says, but the governor wants to please Mr. Hirschhorn's collection, we have to have it up in Westchester Center. And of course, we never got the Hirschhorn collection anyway.
That went down to Washington.
Johnson grabbed it, and it went to Washington. So, but they already had mandated, Rockefeller's typical fashion, ran the thing through, got approval for this college, and he knew, what's his name, who had become the first president there. He had served on some...
Oh, yes.
Committee.
I met him out in California when I was...
Yeah, he was at UCLA.
Yes.
Today my memory's gone on all these names. Anyway...
I was looking for a librarian out there, and I met him, just happened to meet him out there, just before he was coming to Purchase.
And he ended up coming to Purchase, I had a big run-in with him after he came, because I got Gould to accept, and our following year budget with Toll pushing for various priorities to get and to have a center for arts and letters in the 20th century, we called it, and that's we are trying to get various major collections here for archives and whatnot. I'll remember that in a minute too, but at any rate,
something like Andrews.
It was Well, Gould knew him, and Rockefeller knew him, and they just the point, there was no search, nothing, and they just created the play. Everything was done in a matter of a couple of weeks. It was just magical, you know, and they were going to get the whole thing going, because Rockefeller wanted to show Hirschhorn that he meant business, and Hirschhorn, I guess, teased Rockefeller along until he got the best offer, and he went with that. Abbott Kaplan.
That was Kaplan, yes,
Abbott
right.
Kaplan was the name of the president of Purchase.
Purchase,
yeah. No, Alec is a very key figure. As a matter of fact, as I'm talking, I realize that the whole sequence of problems of policy in the master plan and where problems started to develop with Stony Brook, Alec was one perhaps more tuned in on even than Johnny. And I think Johnny fought the battles. He went out, did the thing, but the person who was preparing all of the ammunition for him was Alec, essentially. But we did get along okay. I mean, we knew that we had to sort of draw guidelines as to where our respective turf was going to be, and it worked. I think Alec may have had some problems, or Bentley also had problems with Alec. That was I don't know, it was a personality clash or something. But I realized that, well, as time went on, Alec, although he used to run practically everything with Johnny when he first got into that position, executive vice president,
right.
I think the institution's problem became so complex he had to focus on a certain order of problems.
Right.
And so he wasn't going to create problems for us on the academic side. No, he would be crucial. If it would be help you, I'd be glad to go with you to Princeton.
I'd like to do it.
Rutgers.
Yes, and I'd like, it would mean, I think, we'd have to go, I doubt if we could see him in New York City.
That would be difficult, probably.
Yeah. We'd have to go make a full day of it.
Yeah, drive out to where he is.
New Brunswick somewhere?
New Brunswick, yeah. And I have never been out there. He's invited me a couple of times.
I see.
And last year, as a matter of fact, I thought, and then I got sick, and I was hospitalized, so I never got down there.
I'd like to do it before the winter sets in.
That would be a good time.
If we could do
sometime.
It.
Well, anyway, I have a sabbatical this spring, so I'd like to get it in sometime before the winter sets
okay.
in.
Okay.
Yeah, good.
I'll call him.
Yeah, that would be a big piece that's missing here. Yeah. There's a lot there because he probably would also remember key people who in turn to contact. You see, he would have the kind of connections as a result of his dealings with Albany, since he was running interference for Johnny, basically. He was preparing the groundwork with people both in the Board of Trustees as well as in central administration, division of the budget, legislative committees. He would have the whole span there. Another person of import who today, and who worked as a sidekick for John, but mainly for Alec, was John Burness, who today is vice president of Cornell.
He's vice president of the whole thing, or?
No, vice president of for what's tantamount to what we would call university relations.
University relations.
John Burness is vice president of Cornell for university relations. Now, he was key person because Johnny began to develop a system of division of labor in his operation.
Mm-hmm.
And Burness took over essentially the legislative dealings and contact and with the council.
Mm-hmm.
So that he became the kind of political arm out to both the community, downstate Long Island group, as well as upstate, the major committees in the legislature. So Burness is an important person because he became quite indispensable to Johnny, I think, and to Alec subsequently.
Okay, look, let me interrupt for a minute.
Sure.
And let's go through the specific questions. Remember the set that we developed, because the reason is I want to get this particular structure. This goes quickly. Just take one at a time.
You want me to answer these? No?
Yeah, because I want to find out who you are, when you came.
Oh, well, you have my name, Sidney Gelber, currently Department of Philosophy professor.
But back...
when I came...
When did you come?
I came in 1958.
In 58, as
yes.
What?
As... I guess the title there was, because we had a divisional structure, it was not a departmental structure, it was, I was, I guess, coming as professor of humanities, but I was also to be in charge of division head of social sciences.
Social sciences?
Yeah, and primarily because of the influence of our work at Columbia, they want also want to bring that into play at the
Oyster Bay. You worked in the contemporary civilization.
Yes, I edited their major works. I developed their whole second year sequence of Educate when I was at Columbia and so on. So he wanted people who were rather very well experienced in that,
yes,
as well as Chicago, but he wants Chicago people to essentially be involved with the humanities curriculum and the Columbia people sort of helping develop the social science back. So I came in head of social sciences.
I see.
Well, Stony Brook, I came when Stony Brook opened, of course.
You came in 60, in 58.
58, so that means
that was the second year.
34 years old.
34.
That was the second year of the institution.
Right.
I came from Columbia University. I was, prior to that I'd been at Brooklyn College, but I was at Columbia 8 years. That's an interesting question. Who was primarily responsible for my coming to Columbia? In the first year, three people from Columbia were hired by Olson. He had gone to talk to people at Columbia, key people that were there. And I know the names well because of major controversy developed around these three people later. Ralph Bowen, Manny Chill, and Fleischer. I had worked with these people in developing the curriculum and certain of the important new directions we were developing at Columbia. They had been on staff, and so they were two were younger. One was a more senior person. Chill and Fleischer were more junior. Ralph Bowen was a more senior person. He was a historian. Chill was a historian. Fleischer was a political scientist. During that first year, they kept saying that they wanted to make major moves and to build strong leadership in that whole area of social sciences, and were urging me to come out at least to talk to people.
This was Olson primarily, or?
Olson and working with these people, and they were getting along quite well, all of them, quite well. I was living at the time in. Around in Glencoe, which was not far from there. That was our first home. And so they convinced me at least to come out to talk about, to have an interview. I spent the entire day. I talked with them, with, I don't know if you have Harold Ziskind, who had come the first year, and with Olson. And we talked and talked and talked. And the next thing I know, I got a call from Olson offering me a position there. And the interesting thing is that I didn't take it seriously at all. So much so that we moved, in order for me to be close to Columbia, we then that year moved to Great Neck. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have that awful travel time. It was much easier getting in. And I moved that late winter, early spring. And they kept calling me, you know, would you be serious in coming? And somehow, I just felt it was sort of interesting, but they started playing on a thing that was always important to me because I was very keenly interested in new opportunities for higher education. And then they said, you know, we're going to be really not just a little college, but really a university of some substance eventually. And I guess they worked on me long enough.
This was so in the spring of
spring of 58.
58.
And we started our discussions back in the winter of 57, and just months went on, they kept talking to me, and I guess, it wasn't just interview, these were intense discussions that went on. I came out again, and spent a complete day, from morning to night practically, on many levels discussing things that could be done. And I got very excited by the prospect, quite frankly. I thought, my God, the idea of, I remember coming and saying to Anita, you know, gee, it doesn't happen every day in the week. You can come to them and build a new university. You know, this is a very exciting prospect.
Yeah.
And in spite of the move, you know, I thought, because here earlier would have been a hop, skip, and jump from Glencoe right into Oyster Bay, the back road there. So that's what happened. And that's why I came. It was really the opportunity to build, I thought, a very exciting place. And I really felt that, I remember Jacques Barz in Columbia, very upset, because I had kind of grown up in Columbia, and it was a very paternalistic feeling I had that was dominating over me in a way, because I was an undergraduate, I was a graduate student, I was teaching there, and I was treated well, but it was like a child having to have to grow up finally.
Right.
And I remember making it clear that I was definitely going to go, and I went to see Barzin, who was a graduate dean, I think, at the university. And he very grimly said to me, doesn't make sense you're going. He said, you know, they're not going to last very long.
They're not going to what?
Last very long. Oh. He said, this is just a political ploy to set up these things. And
That's the way the private institutions looked at it.
Exactly. Huh? Yeah. And he said, this is just a temporary aberration of sorts. But this idea that you could build, he said, that's foolish. Not going to happen. So I figured, well, it's worth taking a risk. And so when, within a very short period, when the opportunity came up to have a plan developed, eventually it was to be, of course, the Hill Commission, but there was another plan earlier, the Blagan Report. But the state was very seriously interested in pushing the development of a university. And I was convinced that we could do it. And Olson sold me on the fact that, look, he said, you know, where else could you, I remember saying, all these interesting things you've been developing in higher education, Columbia, which now, and I was getting concerned, Columbia was getting much more much less, what should I say, experimental in some of its attitudes, was getting more lockstep, more locked into place. Very institutionalized. And so that was a very appealing argument that Olson had. And he was a rather interesting guy. He could make the appeal. He had a manner and style about it. Unfortunately, we came into disagreement and conflict on something subsequently. But he did have a genuine kind of intellectual enthusiasm for the whole enterprise, and that was very, very infectious, and that helped. What was your understanding behind the creation of Stone? I really felt that it was going to be the opportunity to create a new university that could hopefully do things on two levels simultaneously, have a unique educational structure that'd be very exciting intellectually, and that would bring people of eminence and a great accomplishment to the university at the same time. And we could have a major input into new frontiers that would be developing. I remember when I first became Dean of Arts and Sciences, well, when Lee came, that's actually what happened. After Lee came, that's when the major judgment was made by him to turn the thing from a divisionalized structure into one that would be genuinely a university. Because I think, see, Olson basically underneath it had, if he didn't have a split personality on the whole issue, he certainly was placing a lot more stress on perhaps a stage development university. The first primary emphasis would be an undergraduate work. There were some of us who were concerned that if we gave complete attention to that the opportunity for a university might be lost, and consequently, when the various reports were being written with the Blagan and the Hill Commission, it became very obvious that they were talking about a university,
yeah.
And The conflict that developed, really, with Olson was whether, and with those people who were very close to him, was whether we should be really talking about a college, per se, or university, basically. Mm-hmm. So when Lee came, he immediately changed the whole rhetoric and the whole language and collapsed that whole divisional structure. Well, of course, we had very strong support from the science people on this. They didn't want a divisionalized structure. And so he created the first College of Arts and Sciences, College of Engineering, and a graduate school. And so it, what he put me, asked me to serve in, as head of Arts and Sciences, and Tom Irvine for engineering, and Feingold for the graduate school. Mm-hmm. And
who hired Tom, you know?
Lee. Mm-hmm. Lee, I think that what actually happened was that Lee had been interviewed by a committee for the dean of engineering, and then after the interview, they thought, gee, he'd be an interesting guy maybe to have president. I think they switched suddenly. I don't know what precisely happened, but he was then offered the presidency, and he brought in Tom, whom he knew very well. They were very close.
They both came from Raleigh.
North Carolina, yeah. Right. And so at that point, I really felt we were going to genuinely carry out this expectation and this goal. And those were the expectations I had, that we would create a major university. The College of Arts and Sciences became the first foundation stone with the various departments. My first interest, I remember going around to getting entree to the Council of Economic Advisors that Kennedy had in Washington, to a couple of people, key people. One was the chairman, one was had come from Williams College, to talk about, could they name some top economists if we want to establish the Department of Economics?
From Williams? Wasn't that Bob was, Brooks, was it?
No, not Bob Brooks. This was Kermit Gordon.
I see.
And he then said, look, you're going to have to hire, none of us know, we don't know what Stony Brook is. You're going to have to hire idiosyncratic. You're going to have to find people who want to come to the place because of their own needs or idiosyncrasies. You're underwater. He said, oh, that's great, because I gave a description of where the campus would be, and then he said, I know a Dutch economist who is having some difficulty, he wants to get away from Holland, and he loves sailing, he loves, might be what's the right place. So it was that kind of thing. We went around, I contacted very well-known people in many areas. Hannah Arendt, I had lunch with her in New York to try to interest her in heading up maybe political science department on political theory. We talked about some very key people in the field of art, for art history. The excitement was there, but then the whole thing blew apart, as you know, with Lee. So those are my expectations. I think they basically have, I know some people have different opinions. Herb Wisey and I didn't see necessarily eye to eye on something. He always felt, well, we could have made it, we didn't make it. We made it. The problem is that it's a very short period of time that we've been in existence. Uniform kind of strength would be almost impossible at this stage and in its development. There had been, both here and other places, there are stronger and weaker elements in any system you set up. It's true, I think there were certain areas where they came on deck at the same time. One was to achieve more rapid and more brilliant development than another department unit at the very same time. A lot had to do with the quality of leadership you had. And Cole's basic theory, you see, eventually always was that the key figure really in the building of a university would be a chairman. And that that's why it was so careful who you started with as chairman. Because if they had the right vision and the right energy, they'd end up doing the right thing. But that would answer most of these questions here. I feel by 1971,
before you get to 71,
yeah.
I know you're talking to me. I want you to be just as precise and accurate as you can be about the year 62 to 65. What function do you think I performed for the institution?
Mm-hmm.
And what problems do you think I faced?
Well, I think that was a very crucial and difficult period of time because at least three different reasons. One was that with the publicity, some of which was good in the sense it got the governor interested in the campus, but some of it which is not good because any publicity, basically is my old theory, that doesn't always sound good, doesn't necessarily help you. So there was just that problem of getting over a difficult period. Secondly, there were lots of difficulty within the campus. You had essentially a split campus. I'm not talking about how numerically divided up. The fact of the matter is, I think what Hamilton and Porter realized, much to their chagrin when they came down, they had misread the situation. They made a great blunder. Harry Porter was to tell me this subsequently. Because when I was pushed out of the arts and science thing because they wanted to reach and alter that whole administrative structure, they thought they could go back to the earlier system, divisionalized structure. They thought that they could have a Hamilton thought it was just simply, you know, quieting the majority of the faculty. They thought the majority of the faculty was